I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
Eliminating greenhouse gas emissions is the name of the game when it comes to dealing with the climate crisis. Big changes need to be made on a global scale to completely stop the destruction of our atmosphere. But there are simple steps we can take in our own lives to help out, starting with the food we eat.
In this episode, we are speaking with chef Alejandro Schroeder, who's written the low-carb cookbook and action plan to help people introduce more plants to their plates. We ask her for some practical tips about plant-based cooking, reducing food waste, and having fun while doing it. Here's Alejandra.
Hello, everyone. My name is Alejandra Schroeder. I am an award-winning author, a plant-based nutrition certified chef, entrepreneur, public speaker, and an activist. I am so passionate about the environment. I care about what I do because our actions have an impact on this planet and our involvement with the way that we live, the way that others live, can make a big difference.
Wonderful introduction. And let's start with your role as a chef, right? You're a chef. Can you explain to us where you're a chef and what kind of food you serve and how many customers
you have? I think we all love to eat, so...
We're always after the tasty food.
I am a chef, and the culinary career, it's probably my third one, not by choice. I sort of fell into this career due to one of many lives' curveballs. I'm actually trained as an urban planner, first as an architect. I graduated from SciArc with a BS in architecture, and then moved on to do a master's in urban and regional planning. However, because of the decline in the economy in 2009, 2010, I lost my career. And after being unemployed for a couple of years, I applied for, basically they made me, between my husband and all my friends and my peers, encouraged me, I guess is the right word, to apply for a cooking show called MasterChef with Gordon Ramsay. And so what that allowed me to do was a passion that I had for something that I didn't know that I could make a career out of. What I learned from my grandmother and my mother in Venezuela, the traditional recipes that I learned, the cooking techniques that were just part of my culture and a very needed one, because I come from very humble upbringing. So cooking everything from scratch and trying to make the most out of the very little that we had, that passion was able to give me a career that I never expected. And so for the last 11, coming on 12 years now, I have been able to build up a culinary career that allows me to continue the passion for sustainability that I already had in my former career, but also to really understand the impact that food has on so many aspects of life. All the way until March of 2020, I had my own business, my own chef business, catering, private chefing, but also restaurant consulting. You know, being a chef implies or involves so many different things, from developing menus to creating recipes for brands, to serving food for others, to doing special events. But that business had to be closed down due to COVID. So yet again, life throws a ball up, you know, a curveball at me. And as it happens so often, these negative events, if you will, have a greater meaning in hindsight. The way that I was working and living was just not sustainable. 70, 75 hours a week, working like crazy, traveling, not sleeping, drinking heavily to cope with all of that. And, you know, I lose my business at the beginning of the pandemic. And my husband and I have been together for centuries, and we had never been able to conceive. We had been told that we couldn't conceive. And sure enough, life changes. And the same weekend, which was a couple of months after I lost my business, that I I get a book deal. Finally, after 10 years, I get a book deal with Penguin Random House. That same weekend, I conceived my first child at that time, 46 years old.
Wow.
Congratulations.
That's amazing. What a story. So tell us a little bit about your book. It's a book of recipes that come out of this experience that you have, right? Tell us a little bit of that, and what can people expect by looking through, trying out your book?
Yes. So the book is called The Low Carbon Cookbook and Action Plan, Reduce Food Waste and Combat Climate Change with 140 Sustainable Plant-Based Recipes. It is a plant-based cookbook that I usually try to make the differentiation that is, it's not necessarily vegan. It's vegan by trade because there's no animal source products, but there's also no vegan sausage and vegan cheese and vegan sour cream. Everything really is made from scratch. Even my mayonnaise, it's made with a food waste ingredient, aquafaba, which we can get into later. So it could be perceived as a very labor-intensive book, but I wanted to give people the option. Look, you want to pursue a plant-based lifestyle diet full-time? Go for it. Do you want to stop eating meat once a week? Do you want to practice meatless Monday? Here, I have an array of recipes that you can try at home. Do you want to help Mother Earth while you're at it and avoid food waste? Here are some tips. How do you use this? How do you use that? And so there are a lot of recipes. There are from entrees and salads, desserts and drinks, but there's also a section that I want, it's one of my favorites, called the make ahead section. It's how do we make the coconut cream or the, like I mentioned, you know, or the mayonnaise or the broth, or that later I can use to make my food and that it will cut up my time because now I have all of these things ready to go in the refrigerator. So there are, in total, it's a 256-page book, and the first almost 60 pages are not recipe-related. It has a very strong, introductory element to why is food related to this climate crisis, and why am I talking about a low-carbon diet? Why is it needed? How is food contributing to this climate crisis that we're currently experiencing? And what can you do to help minimize that?
A moment ago, you talked about how people really don't understand the tremendous impact of what we eat has on our planet. And what would you just go into a few of those impacts and what actually happens?
Yes. So the main one is the amount, the percentage that food has on greenhouse gases. This is something very important that I like to talk about today is only 2 years ago when I was doing the research for my book, science said at the time, and that's the number that you'll find on my cookbook, that 26% of all greenhouse gases that were generated by humans came from food. Well, 2 years later, that research actually is talking about more about a third, somewhere between 30 and 35% of all human generated greenhouse gases come from food. And that is a lot. It's just so vast. And we're talking about all of it from production to consumption to obviously with the packaging, transportation, but it also goes all the way to how much food we waste. And so that could be very overwhelming, but I also I'm a relentless optimist, and I think that that also gives us humans at home cooking food, buying food, a lot of power. It gives us a lot of opportunities to make a difference for the better. And so, yes, whether, you know, while it's true that there's nothing that we can do about how much food gets, there's the difference between food waste and food loss, right? Food loss happens in the production side of food, and food waste happens later at our, you know, once we as consumers get our hand on it. We cannot do anything about agricultural practices. We cannot do much about the fact that the market calls for that beautiful red apple that has no blemishes and that is a certain size, because if it's too small, it has to be thrown away. If it's too big, it has to be thrown away. But what we have a lot of power is, how do we buy our food? Who do we buy it from? How much do we buy? How do we store it? How do we cook it? What do we do with those apple peels or potato peels or the beet greens that I feel like my heart is ripping apart when I go to the market and I see people ripping those carrot greens or beet greens and leaving them on the shelf and taking just the actual root. So we have a lot to do with all of that. And I think that's where education becomes so important, because you talked earlier about passion. I want to inject people with all of this passion to like, look how much in Venezuela we talk about, let's put our grain of sand, because every grain of sand helps build a mountain. And there's not such thing as, oh, I don't do anything because, you know, it's not going to make a big difference. Yes, it is. It's going to make a big difference.
Okay, I think the herbs are included earlier.
The herbs.
I heard that the herbs are in the garden, in the backyard, that you find a lot of things in the backyard. And we live normally in New York. And I was like, oh, I don't think I'm going to go to the backyard. But I can imagine that there is a lot of stuff you find you can eat.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that I come back to your urban design / food interests and the nexus between those two. We spend a lot of time looking at cities and how can cities be more sustainable. The amount of food waste that happens, for example, in New York, where we live most of the time, has so many restaurants just tossing out tons and tons of leftovers every night. And no composting or very little compost. We just started a composting program. And is it composting that would you advocate for that more than trying to eat the carrot peels and the carrot beets or beet trimmings? What do you call it?
The beet leaves.
Or how do you recommend that the average consumer or cook think about using every part of the vegetable?
Yes. So one of the graphics in my book shows an inverted pyramid. And while composting is great for food waste or to mitigate with food waste, it's also at the bottom of that inverted pyramid. There are much greater, more useful, more impactful ways to use our waste before it becomes compost. It includes sharing it with others, even using it as food for animals, whether it's our own pets or you know, livestock, pasture animals, and five others. And so again, yes, it is great to compost, but how about we share that food? I come from, you know, I always talk about Caracas, where I grew up, kind of like a mini New York. It's, you know, very busy, very dense, you know, loud and noisy too. But even in cities like Caracas, in the middle of what right now Venezuela is going through, which is our worst humanitarian crisis in history, people have had to get creative. And so here's, you know, when we bring it back to New York City, I guess, you know, we have a problem of privilege, right? We can afford to throw away that peel because we don't, you know, we have a bank account that allows us to go back and buy more food. But when you don't have the access or the money for it, then you start finding creative ways. And I'll tell you one. In fact, it's probably one of the main motivations behind my newly found passion for food waste. You know, my mother lives in Venezuela, my sister, nieces, and nephews. So I've been here for many years, but my family still lives there. That's still home to me. And my mom would say things like, you know, like, oh, I couldn't, you know, I can't find any you know, tuna. And so I said, well, I'll send you money. She's like, no, you don't understand. You can send me all the money that you want, but I just don't, I cannot find it. And so because of that lack of access to certain foods, people started to get very resourceful. And that's when I first heard about people using plantain and banana peels to shred and use as a meat substitute. That's when I first heard about people going back to things that we used to eat culturally and that we stopped, like amaranth and amaranth leaves. People started to do urban foraging. They started to go to the banks of the freeways where there's plenty of amaranth, and they'll bring it home and they'll eat the greens, which by the way are delicious, and they'll saute them with, you know, some aromatics like garlic and onions, and then they'll put those flowers, beautiful flowers, to dry so that they could shake them up and get the seeds. And now they have this, gorgeous and delicious, but also highly nutritious ingredient at home. And so all this food is free, right? And so I try to use that knowledge base to bring it now to the reality here in the United States, where, you know, you may not need to eat banana peels because you don't have enough money to buy tuna, but it's absolutely delicious. And so why not?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, why not? And I'm getting intrigued here because I am one of those who actually always threw away the leaves of the carrot, for example. Like, or what do you call it? what do you call it? The green
the
stuff
of the carrot. The carrot tops or the carrot greens?
The greens. Right? So yeah, I honestly threw it away because I thought
it's
useless.
Better.
So you tell me I can use it. Can I really use it? It's stuff which I would imagine, especially in the United States, you know, you never know what they put on their fields, pesticides and everything else. Is it really good for me to eat that stuff? Even though if it's treated, do I need to wash it? It's very practical now, but I actually really get intrigued.
No, right. So I mean, there's several layers to this. Like, I know that I am very privileged that I get to buy my carrots organic. In fact, in the state of California where I live, most likely I get to buy it organic and from a regenerative farm. So I know that there's not all the, you know, bad stuff added to it. But there are also ways to mitigate that. And, you know, the science also talks about, for those that cannot afford, an organic ingredient. And I'm not sure if you've heard these lists about the dirty dozen and the clean 15. So like the foods that, okay. So the dirty dozen are like those 12 ingredients that you really, 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 you know, should avoid unless it is organic.
What are they?
Some of them, strawberry, peach, usually things that have like a fuzzy skin because its ability to absorb and retain some of these like fertilizers. But the science also talks about like, it's better that you eat a non-organic strawberry that you don't eat a strawberry at all, or, you know, fruits or certain vegetables. With carrot tops, Stephanie, specifically, first of all, because the carrot tops or carrot greens are coarse, the texture is not as soft and delicate as, you know, an herb or a lettuce or spinach. Then you want to pass those, like poach them, right? You want to pass them through boiling water. And in that process, there's a lot of cleaning that happens. Also with carrot tops, carrot greens, there's a very easy technique, which you run your fingers through each of the bigger stems, and now you're removing the more fibrous or stocky, you know, part of the green. And then now you have these wilted, tender leaves to use. Also, because carrot greens is probably one that I would suggest that you grind and or that you blend and use a blender to make, whether it's a salsa verde or a pesto sauce, then once you process them, then you're not really, you know, dealing with that texture. And that's why I talk about the importance of having chefs involved in this education. Like, let me show you how you can make this ingredient delicious. Because here's what's important. On one end, you know, carrot greens can be half, if not more, of the entire plant, right? So then there's all these resources that are getting lost or literally wasted. But then there's so much nutrition on those greens. There's phytochemicals, there's antioxidant properties, anti-inflammatory properties, tons of vitamins and minerals and macronutrients that, why not utilize, you know, and reap all the benefits and all the health benefits of these plants. There are others that are like, you know, the radish greens, for instance. Oh, they are beautiful and tender. Most times the issue with radish greens is because of the way that they're stored in the supermarket. They get, you know, maybe a little too roughed up, and so they're not as pretty. But if you're getting them from a farmer's market or a community supported agriculture box, you just wash those and you use them as your greens for your salad, and they're delicious and tender and a little peppery like arugula would be.
It sounds like it's such an easy sell when I hear you talk about it, but so many of us, I think I'm included in this, that once in a while I just really want meat. Like, there's something my body craves, that meat. I wonder if there's a rule of thumb about how to select the most sustainable or the most responsible way of eating a meat-based or an animal-based protein, that you could give us meat eaters advice about that.
And everyone has a seat at my table. I am the most omnivore loving plant-based chef. I, if anything, want to change the paradigm and help you change perspective. And even if I get you to avoid meat one meal a week, I feel like I have won this fight, you know. Maybe you for a month try Meatless Mondays, this beautiful movement that is just trying to encourage meat-loving people to just one day a week do not consume animal products. Maybe I even get to a very victorious point where I encourage you to not eat red meat half the time. Half the time you can eat red meat, but the other half you choose another sort of poultry or fish, and then you are now cutting your own individual carbon footprint by about 40%. Imagine that, like, what a huge difference you can make on this planet by just reducing the amount of whether it's red meat or other animal source products. So that's why I talk about my book being like, yeah, even if it's that one meal a week, just grab the book.
That's amazing. Like 40%. Did you do the calculation? What it mean for, let's say, the United States, if every 10th person would do that? Could we do this calculation, Mel? I'm looking at you.
Well, that would mean, I don't know.
did you do some calculations?
We can definitely do the calculation. The science does talk about, right, like the impact of like doing that cutting. And you know, the way I like to explain it to kids, because, you know, people are like, well, would I have the same effect if I eat half the chicken that I normally eat? And here's why red meat is so important, right? Like cows as part of the ruminant and, you know, groups. The way I talk to kids about it is really funny, because I've tried to talk this way in front of professional adults, and it hasn't been as funny for them as it's for little kids. I say, well, the way that they burp and fart, it's really not good for our planet. It's called enteric fermentation. That's the way their digestive system works. And because of that, they produce a lot of methane gases. And methane gases are one of the worst and more impactful greenhouse gases. And so it does make a difference whether you... And you actually, Stephanie, you brought up a very important point. We're talking about the United States of America, where industrialized animal production is not done right. We're not talking about, you know, free ranging and grass grazing cows. We're talking about cows that are never seen the light of the day, that are stuck in a cage that barely fits their bodies. And so because of our consumption patterns of red meat, especially here in our country, we should be making adjustments to the way that we eat.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
And I don't understand how people can think that consuming, I don't know whether we're going to do this on the podcast, right? But this is something I really don't understand. It's so clear that if you don't treat an animal well, there is some sort of energy which you will eat later on. And I don't understand that. I've never understood that. So why not just eat happy animals? You know, if you want to eat some meat. Anyway, so this isn't a discussion we have.
But it's a very good point that you're raising, right? Because then that's the reason why vegan people they do it for animal welfare. You know, here I am pursuing a plant-based diet because I understand that it has an impact on my mother earth and on my health and also on the livelihoods of people. But some people are considering what you're talking about, the energetic charge or even just the animal welfare of those animals that people eat.
And frankly, even once you've tasted, let's say, a really happy chicken and a really unhappy chicken, I don't think you will ever go back to the unhappy chicken. The problem is that a lot of people cannot afford or think they cannot afford. And I think this is kind of your point. Think what you were trying to do in your cookbook. Well, and there was no chicken in there, but...
Yeah, and usually the point that I love to make is if you think you cannot afford really good quality poultry, whether it's chicken, Cornish hen, turkey, whatnot, pound per pound, any vegetable, any plant-based ingredient is just cheaper than any animal source protein. And you probably get greater quality of it. And I think that this is one of the points where I like to bring up, like, the reason why I went to get educated and got a plant-based nutrition certification is because the first question people would ask me is, but where did you get your protein? And I would say, where do you think cows are getting it from? You know? So, you know, like, I am able to understand how plant-based protein is so rich and much more affordable, you know. And if you do like a comparison and you look at one cup of green lentils and one cup of brown red meat, you're looking at a very, very comparable amount of protein when you have those two side by side. Then the other argument that I like to make is there are, for me, right? Like, so the science, it keeps changing. Anywhere between 30 and 50,000 varieties of edible plants on this planet of ours. And we are doing a horrible job at doing that justice. 60% of humanity's calories come from three crops: corn, wheat, and soy. The average American eats only 30 types of plants. Again, the science says 30 to 50,000 on this planet. So we're doing a very, very horrible job, you know, eating such a small percentage. So instead of focusing on what we don't get to eat, what sacrifice we have to do to not put that big T-bone steak on our plate, why don't we focus on the vast array of vegetable, leafy greens, roots, fruits, nuts, algae, fungi, like beautiful wild mushrooms that we get to put on our plate. At the very least, we can reduce a little bit of the animal source products that we put on our plate and try to maximize and increase how many vegetables, fruits, and plants we get to put on our plate.
You know, that's an astounding number, 30,000 to 50,000 plants that we could eat, yet we're only eating three or four, really. You know, and I think part of that is about production, right? We try to maximize production, and so we have to pick a plant, essentially, to feed people at scale.
You talked about the lack of variety due to, you know, maximizing production. And my strongest case is really against monocrop culture, especially here in the United States, because of what it does to our soils, because of what it does to our planet. You just have to catch a plane and fly over, you know, across the United States, and you'll see a lot of yellow fields. Monocrop culture kills our soil. It depletes it from the nutrients. It doesn't allow the time to replenish those nutrients. And so we end up killing our soil. The opposite of that would be like using cover crops, doing crop rotation, allowing a field to produce more than one crop within a, you know, in a year or within seasons, so that, you know, we give our soil back what we've taken away from it, including carbon sequestration. You know, a lot of times I advocate for, I've mentioned it before, I love beans, I love pulses, because pulses are not like, they will allow the nitrogen to be reintroduced. So they're nitrogen fixing plants, and that's what they're great to use as cover crops. And so, you know, that argument is against what, you know, we talked about, like the little vegetables that we eat, because, you know, the production. Before I forget, I'll leave people with this one tip. Like, next time you go to a farmer's market, try to look at one ingredient that you've never had before. Just be adventurous. Like, buy it. Ask, oh, I don't know how to cook it. Ask that farmer, how can I cook this? How? And they will be so happy, not just to have your support and your dollar, but to also tell you, how is it that you can make this at home? And now you've expanded what I like to call your culinary palette. Imagine yourself as a painter, and you've added one more color to that palette, and you've increased and expanded, you know, your use of plants on this world.
That's a great tip. I'm going to try it next time.
We'll do that. Well, tomorrow.
Because I think part of it is having the customers ask the farmer, could you bring something new? Like, you know, I feel like there's an ongoing dialogue here, that it's not just about us picking the latest thing, but also being a demand for new experiences in plant-based diets. And, you know, I would love to try different flavors.
Do you see that there is a trend for chefs to change menu, or even like the strategy for running restaurants? I mean, basically from all the chefs in New York City, I only know one who really radically excluded meat and fish, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, chefs, we have the platform necessary to make such a big difference. I am aware that being a chef is cool now, is in. We get people to listen. We get customers to come sit at our tables and ask questions. We have educated guests also that want to know, that keep us accountable, that there has to be a certain amount of transparency. So, obviously we can generalize, but I would say most chefs are aware of that privilege and that responsibility that we have now. And so even full-on meat-loving chefs, then they're talking about the nose-to-tail movement. How do we maximize? If we're going to sacrifice this animal, how do we maximize like every piece of this animal, and we're not throwing parts away? For me, like a plant-based chef, I would say from root to leaf, right? Like, how do I utilize all of the plant, including the peels and the seeds and everything that gets me really excited? But this great privilege, it gives us we have a platform, and we're being listened to, and not just by our consumers. I get to do quite a lot of advocacy work. I do, I'm an ambassador with Oxfam America, and I am one of the founding members of the Chef's Manifesto, which is a United Nations effort, if you will. And, you know, when I've gone to Congress and I've met with Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and with back then Senator Kamala Harris, I've worn my chef coat, which I, you know, part of me, I thought, I feel silly. I'm like, whoa, but I'm not cooking. And the word was, but they'll listen to you. You have a chef coat on. So that's, you know, that to me, that actually gives me, that gets me very excited, because then if I'm going to be listened to, because I have this unique perspective about food that will help the science, the policy advocacy, you know, and be more impactful than, you know, the better. I think that plant-based diet is not for everyone. And I think some chefs are aware of that. And so what they try to do is educate the consumer by highlighting on their menu this, you know, like, let's just say, oh, I'm serving you, a sea bass, da-da-da-da-da, with Apricot Lane Farms greens with, you know, and I'm trying to think of the own farmers that I, you know, that I work with. And so now I'm highlighting the work and the product of nearby farmers that that consumer that happens to live in the same neighborhood that I do has access to. And now they're going to try to go and buy from that farmer, and where, oh, which farmer's market do they go to? Oh, hey, hi, I tasted your, you know, chard at Chef Alejandro's pop-up restaurant last weekend. Oh yeah, it's this rainbow chard. Oh, let me take. And so there's this bridging, right? Consumers and farmers, and cutting the middleman and heightening and highlighting and showcasing the work of smallholder farmers out there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love it. I will explore your book immediately when I return to New York.
And I will excitedly help you out.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that support.
Alejandro, this has been a really wonderful discussion, and we're very happy we found you, or you found us. It's really great. And is there anything, parting words? So you already gave us one tip. Is there anything else you'd like to talk to our listeners about before we sign off?
Yeah, I would say just give it a try. I cannot encourage you enough to maybe make one meal a day or a week at home that has no animal source ingredients, and just give plants a chance. It will do wonders for you, and it will be doing amazing wonders for the planet. I think that we are only going to be able to get out of this climate crisis by all of us putting our little grain of sand, and the collective effort is going to make a big difference. And if we're all willing to make that little sacrifice for the sake of the greater good, we will be good.
Thank you so much. Well, that was food for thought.
Right? Oh, for sure. I love Alejandra. I think she's doing a fantastic job, and I can't wait to get that cookbook in my hands. So why do you think chefs are so important in changing our perspective on food?
Well, chefs, kind of like fashion magazines, kind of control to what we eat. Like, it's trendy to eat polenta, or not trendy to eat lentils or stuff like that. The chefs really do have quite a bit of a say in kind of the global food market, I think.
Well, it is what we need on a daily basis. So food is for sure super important when we want to reduce or do something ourselves. This is something we can, we have control over. But we also need to have discipline, right? I mean, to switch off the meat input for a lot of people will be a huge change. But maybe we can also start by simply thinking of basically what we discussed with Alejandra, the quality of meat, where it comes from, the energy, and is it really good for your body? And all of, I mean, it is fantastic how diverse the subject is, and the really diverse topic, and how important it is for our lives.
Yeah.
What you eat is what you are.
I love that she's not an absolutist. She said, take a step. Take a step, and then take another step. And that's something I can deal with. I can take a step. Well, the other thing that's true is that not everyone has access to good veggies. And that's a problem that we need to solve.
I think that's outrageous. You know, really outrageous that sometimes food is only diverse and good for the rich, basically, or the modern Western world, you know, while indigenous food, I mean, we had a couple of episodes on indigenous food, like herbs from India, for example, the Indian Krishna and permaculture, or the production of food. And I mean, by the way, huge advantages or advancements there in the permaculture movement. Well, I hope it's becoming available for everyone.
Yeah, I can't wait to start our little kitchen garden.
Plant-based, Mel.
Plant-based.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Brought to you by Game Changers, www.gamechangers.world. For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.